Immediately? Rapidly, yes. The path of the gunshot and whether or not it had perforated Travis's brain would be a sticking point for the defense, as their client was contending that, after dropping Travis's camera during their picture-taking session in the shower, Travis had become enraged and chased her to the bedroom and around the closet. It was here that she claimed she found a gun and shot him, a scenario that would be impossible based on Dr. Horn's testimony that the gunshot would have rendered Travis incapacitated and unable to move, much less chase after her. Arias's story would also be impossible because, as she told Detective Flores during her June 10, 2008 phone call, Travis did not have a gun in the house. So, if that's the scenario in this case, we have the defensive wounds to the hands. What does that tell you about the sequencing of these three injuries? I believe the wounds to the hands must have occurred before the fatal injuries either of the head or of the throat, Dr. Horn explained. So what you're saying is that at some point during the stabbing, but before the slashing of the throat and before the gunshot to the head, this individual grabbed the knife. Attempted to. It was a powerful image, Travis in the shower trying to grab at the knife as it slashed toward him. Tell me about the sequencing of events as applied to the two injuries, the one to the head and the slitting of the throat, and when this individual may have grabbed the knife or the knife was applied to his hands. With the throat wound and the head wound, I don't think this person could have had a purposeful activity, meaning I don't think they could have raised their arms and attempted to defend themselves. With a chest wound, that's possible because he would not have been immediately unconscious. Which wound would have been first, in your opinion? Well, the stab wound could have occurred and then the defensive injuries could have happened after the wound to the chest occurred. And then in terms of the sequence of the injuries involving the throat injury we talked about, what is your opinion? Well, the throat injuries and or the head wound are going to be immediately incapacitating, and he's not going to attempt to defend himself after that. In terms of the shot to the head, do you have an opinion as to whether or not he was alive at the time that that shot was struck? I can't say. Do you have an opinion as to the wound to the neck? Whether or not he was alive at the time that that was rendered, if you will. I believe he was. There's a great deal of hemorrhage associated with that. And was he alive with regard to the one to the chest that we have been talking about? Yes, I believe he was. Beyond indicating that the strike to the chest was the first mortal blow, Dr. Horn's testimony was important in highlighting for the jury another aspect of Arias's plan to kill Travis. The mortal blows were inflicted by two separate weapons, a gun and a knife. Arias's preparedness in bringing a backup weapon should the other fail went a long way in proving that she planned the attack. The three mortal wounds, along with the more than 20 non-fatal injuries, speak to overkill and demonstrate Arias's single-minded intent to end Travis's life, even if it took repeated knife strikes and switching to a gun to deliver a parting shot. With the end of my direct examination of Dr. Horn, Jennifer Wilmot rose to begin her cross-examination. As I suspected, Wilmot spent a good deal of time working to infuse doubt into Horn's testimony by questioning his opinion that the bullet had perforated the brain. If she could have him admit that he was uncertain whether it had gone through the front part of the brain, she could argue in favor of Arias's claim that the bullet was the first injury she inflicted, not the last. Horn did not waver, maintaining that he could determine both the path of the bullet and when it was fired in relation to the other injuries. You didn't find any evidence of trauma or, like, a bullet track through the brain? She asked. Nothing so clearly defined, no hemorrhage, no foreign bodies, no metal fragments, right? Dr. Horn repeated his findings. For the most part, if you have a bullet pass through the brain, you're not going to be standing, you're not going to be functional, you're going to fall. Well, just so we're clear, you don't actually have any medical evidence of it passing through the brain, right? Wilmot prodded, attempting to use earlier testimony that he had not been able to determine the bullet's track through the brain because the brain was already decomposed when he conducted his examination. Her apparent goal was to cast doubt on the entirety of Dr. Horn's findings by claiming that he was going beyond what the medical examination had revealed by maintaining that the bullet had passed through the brain. It had to have passed through the brain, Dr. Horn replied emphatically. You don't have medical evidence of that, do you? I do, Dr. Horn insisted. The skull is perforated where the brain is, so it had to have passed through the brain, but you have no idea. You have no medical evidence of how far or what part of the brain it exactly would have hit, right? It would have passed through the right frontal lobe, Dr. Horn replied. I don't have any evidence of hemorrhage now because of the decomposition, but it had to have passed through the brain because of the part of the skull that was injured. The brain in a young person especially is flush against that structure. The brain occupies the entire skull, so to have a hole in the skull here, he indicated the area of Travis's right temple on the autopsy photo, and then exit in here, he pointed to Travis's left cheek, it has to pass through the brain. Having failed to shake Dr. Horn's testimony about the bullet track through the brain, Wilmot moved on to other topics, including testimony that had been given by Detective Flores at an earlier hearing that appeared to differ from Dr. Horn's. Isn't it true that at some point you told Detective Flores that you believed the first wound was a shot to the head? I don't remember ever saying that. Do you think that you never told Detective Flores that? Wilmot asked. I don't think that's consistent with the evidence that I have, and I don't remember ever saying anything like that, Dr. Horn repeated. So what your testimony is, I just want to be clear, is that you never told Detective Flores that the gunshot wound was the first wound. I don't believe I ever said that, no. And do you remember telling Detective Flores that you knew this because the gunshot wound wouldn't have completely incapacitated somebody? I don't recall saying that either, Dr. Horn stated. She continued to press this point, attempting to sow doubt in Dr. Horn's words, or at the very least make it appear that he was contradicting himself. Horn was confident in his opinion and eventually, having failed to shake his testimony, Wilmot gave up and ended her cross-examination. Dr. Horn's testimony that he recovered a bullet from Travis's left cheek that forensics firearms examiner Elizabeth Northcutt found to be consistent with a .25 caliber round made it important for me to bring in Officer Kevin Friedman of the Wairika Police Department. Officer Friedman testified that he responded to a cold burglary on May 28, 2008, at around 3:40 p.m. at the Pine Street home that Arias shared with her grandparents, Caroline and Carlton Allen. He conducted the investigation, which included looking at the point of entry on the south side of the house, taking fingerprints, and determining what had been taken. Officer Friedman portrayed the burglary as unusual, explaining that four items had been taken: a DVD player, a stereo, $30 in bills, and a black-handled .25 caliber gun, just one item from each of the home's four rooms, while small items worth money and a large amount of change had been left behind. Officer Friedman also testified that he thought it was strange that only one of the firearms, the black-handled .25 caliber handgun, was stolen from the dresser that had been converted into a gun cabinet, where other handguns of various calibers were also kept. The .25 caliber handgun taken from Arias's grandparents' house was the same caliber as the casing found in Travis's bathroom. The jury already knew by Arias's own admission to Detective Flores that Travis did not have any guns in his house, leaving no doubt that she had staged the burglary in order to obtain her grandfather's gun to help carry out her plan to end Travis's life. I continued my case by calling Detective Nathan Mendez, formerly the lead detective of the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office's Major Crime Unit, and had him testify to Arias's efforts to hide her identity for her trip to Mesa. Detective Mendez and his team had assisted detectives from the Mesa Police Department in locating and arresting Arias at her grandparents' home in Yreka. Detective Mendez, who was now a special agent for the United States Department of the Interior, had also helped execute the search warrant on Arias's grandparents' Pine Street home that same day, so I intended to introduce the receipts from the Airwalk shoebox through his testimony. I showed the detective a photograph of the small bedroom in which the shoebox had been found during the execution of the search warrant. "Did police have occasion to search this box here?" I asked, pointing to the white box with the red logo that sat atop the twin bed with the patriotic red, white, and blue quilt. "Yes, sir." Holding up the bundle of receipts that had been found inside the box, I asked if he recognized them. "Yes, sir. These are items taken during the service of the search warrant," he replied. "I move for admission of Exhibits 237.001 through 237.022, I said, knowing there would be no objection because defense counsel would think those receipts actually helped corroborate Arias's story that the detour to Mesa was the result of an impromptu decision after speaking with Travis while she was already on the road. "No objection, Your Honor," Nurmi said. One by one, in a serial fashion, almost bordering on the mechanical, I showed each receipt to the jury through the testimony of Detective Mendez, only pausing long enough to identify the various merchants and the dates of each purchase, and sometimes mentioning Jody Arias as the person who had made the transaction. The first receipt I showed Detective Mendez was the one from Budget Rent-A-Car System for the Ford Focus that Arias had rented at the Reading Airport. I turned my attention to establishing Arias's aim of not being recognized on the day she rented the vehicle. "Back in June 2008, were there car rental companies in Yreka?" I asked. "Yes, sir, there are at least two others," the detective said. "There was Hertz and Enterprise." "But there was Budget there, right?" "No, sir." "Are you familiar with Redding, California?" I asked. "Yes, sir." "In fact, you live near Redding now, or not?" "Yes, I do." "And with regard to Redding as it relates to Yreka, how far apart are they?"
"Just under 90 miles.
"And approximately, what is the driving time between Yreka and Redding, California?" I asked.
"In the summertime, about an hour and a half," Detective Mendez said, explaining that it could be a longer drive in the winter because there's a lot of snow in Siskiyou County.
I next asked Detective Mendez about his visit to the budget counter at the Reading Airport to show the photographic lineup of five pictures, including a mugshot of Jody Arias labeled as number 5, to the rental car agent Rafael Colombo. "What did he say when you showed him that in terms of the identification?"
"He said that the person that came in and rented the vehicle was number 5, except that she had blonde hair when she came in and got the car," Mendez told the jury.
Moving the questioning back to the items that had been found in the Airwalk shoebox, I showed Detective Mendez the remainder of the receipts for his identification, going through the different stops that Arias had made, including the gas stations, bank, and Walmart. I didn't want to call undue attention to the transactions at the Arco gas station in Pasadena, where Arias made 3 separate gas purchases, so I purposely did not focus on the amount of gasoline purchased, but instead concentrated on the times those purchases were made. I wanted the jury to see that there were 3 sheets of paper associated with the 3 different sales so that there would be no confusion later when I questioned Arias about the 3 separate purchases, if she took the stand as I predicted. I also wanted to make sure they were not thinking there had only been 2 sales, so I asked a question in a way that emphasized that the 2 cash receipts were not repeats of each other, careful not to go any further, and ended my direct examination. From the line of questioning that Nurmi pursued during his short cross-examination, it was apparent the defense was not concerned with any of the purchases Arias made on her trip. Instead, Nurmi focused his questions on the 3 deposits Arias made at the Washington Mutual Bank in Pasadena.
From his questions, it appeared that the source of the money was somehow significant to the defense, although for me it was just a time marker that Arias had stopped at the bank in Pasadena at 10:15 a.m. on her way to Mesa to kill Travis. To support Detective Mendez's testimony, I called Rafael Colombo, who told jurors about renting the car to a blonde-haired Jody Arias. West Jordan Police Detective Michael Gallietti then testified about the traffic stop in which he observed that Arias's back license plate was upside down and the front one was missing. Ryan Burns was in court to testify to Arias's late arrival in Utah, the excuses she provided for her tardiness, the traffic stop by police, and the sexual contact the two engaged in during her brief time in West Jordan. On cross-examination, defense counsel continued along the same path they had taken with Detective Flores of attacking Travis's character rather than focusing on the evidence that undermined Arias's self-defense claim. Nurmi asked Burns if he had heard from others that Travis was a big flirt and whether Arias had told him that Travis had cheated on her. The line of questioning was out of place because it didn't address the conflicting stories Arias had told him about her delayed arrival, her phone charger, and the upside-down back license plate. Using this witness to try to establish what they wanted the jury to perceive as Travis's inappropriate interactions with women was misplaced, as Burns had no personal knowledge and could only speak to what Arias and a few others had told him. On the ninth and final day of my case in chief, I called my last witnesses, among them Detective Flores again. As part of my direct examination of Flores, I played the telephone message Arias had left for the detective on June 21st, in which she provided her mobile phone number, setting the stage for the introduction of the phone records through the testimony of the custodian of records for the mobile phone carrier Sprint. What I hadn't expected was the line of questioning Nurmi would pursue during his cross-examination of Flores that inadvertently emphasized Jody Arias's momentous error in leaving the camera behind in the washing machine on the day she killed Travis.
Detective, you were present when the photos of Ms. Arias and Mr. Alexander were shown in court?
Nurmi asked Flores.
Yes.
And that was a few weeks after the investigation that those photographs were actually recovered, right?
Yes.
Before they obtained those, had you had any other evidence that Ms. Arias was at Mr. Alexander's home on June 4th?
Nurmi continued, to which Flores answered, no. After 9 days of testimony and 20 different witnesses, it was now clear to the jury that Arias believed everything had gone according to her plan. And it had, except for that one slip-up that Flores was able to highlight in his final testimony. As planned, I concluded with Arias's PPL friend, Leslie Udy, who testified to several conversations she'd had with Arias, including the two telephone calls Arias made to her after supposedly learning of Travis's death. Udy described Arias's apparent sadness and claims of disbelief. Udy's testimony was meant to remind the jurors that Arias's feigned disbelief at the news of Travis's death was just another part of her cover-up. Most emblematic of this deception was the hour-long conversation Udy had with Arias on the evening of June 5, 2008, as the two sat in Arias's rental car in the parking lot of Chili's, days before Travis's body would be discovered stuffed in the shower.
We talked about Travis, Udy recalled. She said they weren't together anymore, which I already knew, but that they would always be friends, and that they had joked and laughed about the fact that at some point further on, they would see each other at the prepaid legal events, and their children would play together and be friends. She indicated that although they were broken up and weren't together anymore, they would always be best friends.
Udy also recounted for the jury the two telephone calls she received from Arias, the first on the morning of June 10, 2008, telling her Travis was dead, and the second around 2 o'clock the following morning. And what was she saying, I asked, with regard to the second call?
She was saying that this was about the time of day that she would normally talk to Travis, They were both night people and that they talk about that time, and that she had lost her best friend and that she didn't know what to do. It was then that I asked Udi the final question of my case in chief. In any of those three conversations, did she ever tell you that she killed Travis? No, she replied. Udi's testimony helped unveil the deviousness that was Jody Arias, someone who would even manipulate her own friend in her time of grief. But her full unmasking would have to wait until cross-examination, where her dark soul would finally be exposed. Chapter 18. On Thursday, January 17th, I rested my case, and the court indicated that trial would resume with the beginning of the defense's presentation of evidence on Tuesday, January 29th, giving us a 12-day recess. But while those 12 days offered a break from the trial, there would be no shortage of drama. The court set an evidentiary hearing for Monday, January 28th, to hear evidence of supposed prosecutorial misconduct, one of the many occasions when such an allegation would be made by defense counsel as the trial progressed. Defense counsel refused to tell me what acts they believed constituted the misconduct and which witnesses would testify in support of their latest accusation, giving them an obvious tactical advantage at the upcoming hearing. Fortunately, their key witness, someone named Gus Searcy, talked to others about the hearing and his upcoming testimony, claiming it would change the course of the trial. Searcy, an executive director at Prepaid Legal Services, now called Legal Shield, held himself out as the paradigm of success at the network marketing company. He had met Arias at a PPL business briefing in Arizona when she approached him to help her attain the kind of success that he professed to have achieved, because, as he was quick to say, he had become an executive director in 90 days, a rate of progress that normally takes more than a year for others to achieve. Searcy's lack of discretion gave me the necessary forewarning about the allegation he would make at the hearing, where he intended to accuse Travis's friend and mentor, Chris Hughes, of trying to sway his testimony. This allowed me to contact Hughes, who denied the allegations and agreed to travel to Phoenix to give testimony at this hearing. After taking testimony from Searcy and Hughes out of the presence of the jury, Judge Stevens found that there was no merit to the defense's claim of prosecutorial misconduct. With the conclusion of Monday's hearing, defense counsel informed me that Searcy would be one of two witnesses to take the stand on the following day, the first day of their case. Although I had only been informed 6 days earlier that Searcy would be a witness at all. This was extremely late notice and left me with very little time to prepare. But at least this time they let me know he would take the stand the next day, rather than refusing to identify him, as they had done for the prosecutorial misconduct hearing. I knew Searcy did not have any information that spoke to either the events leading up to or immediately following the murder, so it was hard for me to speculate what substance, if any, his testimony would contain. Defense counsel also informed me that Daryl Brewer was the other witness they intended to call the next day. As I sat at the prosecution table next to Detective Flores that Tuesday morning, I was on edge, hoping to hear Brewer's name called first. I was a bit disappointed when I heard that the first witness would be Searcy. The thought that ran through my mind was that something might happen between now and the afternoon when Brewer was expected to be called to the stand, because there was always the remote possibility the defense might alter their trial strategy, which might lead them to decide not to call Brewer as a witness. But I let that thought slip by and concentrated on Searcy as the short man with thinning hair, dressed in a dark suit, yellow tie, and matching handkerchief peeking out of his jacket pocket, made his way up the aisle of the gallery to the witness box. Nurmi rose to begin his direct examination by asking Searcy about his affiliation with Prepaid Legal Services / Legal Shield. If you could, what is your position within the company? Is there a label for it? Nurmi asked.
I am what's called a $100,000 ring earner, Searcy replied with a smile, showing the jury the ornate gold band on his left ring finger. I have this little ring, which means I make over $100,000 a year, whether I get out of bed or not. And I am an executive director, he proclaimed.
Could you educate us all on the hierarchy of prepaid legal or legal shield? Nurmi followed up. How that works in terms of where an executive director fits in?
Legal Shield is a multi-level network marketing company that provides a legal insurance product and an identity theft product. And it has about a little over 400,000 associates. Out of those 400,000 associates, the goal is to attain a level such as myself or some of the other people in the company. The main level that people want to get to is something called an executive director. He boasted with a bit of a grin on his face. After talking a bit more about PPL, Searcy went on to tell jurors about Arias approaching him after a business briefing in Arizona, requesting that he provide her with some guidance on how to raise her income by increasing the number of people she could sign up as associates. He said after their initial meeting he saw Arias about 4 to 6 times at national and regional conferences, as well as meeting with her privately on 2 separate occasions. He was quick to point out that the relationship was platonic. His story became disjointed when he recalled one of the times that he met Arias alone, explaining she spent the night at his motorhome in Las Vegas. It was during this visit, as they sat close to each other on separate couches in the motorhome, that Searcy claimed to have overheard a heated phone call between Arias and Travis Alexander, whom he knew to be her boyfriend. Searcy recounted that when Arias answered the call, she immediately became upset, and before he could blurt out what he supposedly heard Travis say to her, I objected on the grounds of hearsay. The court sustained my objection, restricting him from telling the jurors anything he might have heard Travis say during the call. He was left to describe how Arias took the phone outside to continue the discussion in private, which lasted about 30 minutes. When she came back in, she was shaking and crying, Searcy recalled. It appeared that Nurmi had been trying to introduce aspects of that phone conversation to make it seem that Travis had said something abusive to Arias, causing her to become upset. But his effort came up short because the judge sustained my objection that whatever Searcy claimed to have overheard could not be introduced for the jury's consideration. With the conclusion of Searcy's direct testimony, I couldn't help but think about how strange it was that the defense had opted to call him as their first witness. As lead witnesses go, he was not impactful because he had little to talk about other than giving an overview of the PPL/Legal Shield structure and talking about the phone call from Travis. Since Searcy knew nothing about the killing, I restricted myself to discussing only the areas touched on by defense counsel, as I did not want to prolong his stay on the witness stand for fear there would not be any time left for them to call Daryl Brewer that day. My questions focused on having Searcy admit that PPL/Legal Shield had many of the earmarks of a pyramid scheme, knowing that this type of affiliation would affect his credibility as a witness. I further inquired about what seemed a tawdry aspect of his relationship with Arias by asking him about the one occasion when she spent the night. You said that you did see her on a personal level on 2 occasions, right?
Yes.
And one of them involved your mobile home, right?
Motor home, Searcy corrected me.
Motor home, right?
Yup,
Searcy replied in a glib fashion, as if irritated by the question.
And she came by and she stayed 2 days and 1 night, right?
Correct.
Where was this mobile home, sir?
Las Vegas. Searcy was confirming that Arias spent the night in a small motorhome with a man who was a relative stranger to her. By all appearances, this spoke to his bias as well as to Arias's poor judgment. Searcy completed his testimony at around 11:30, at which time Judge Stevens called for a lunch break and indicated that proceedings would resume at 1:30 that afternoon.
Even though I had time, I opted not to eat. I wasn't feeling hungry, and instead went back to my office to wait the 2 hours before court was set to resume. After so many months of waiting, I was finally going to have the opportunity to begin exposing Arius's self-defense claim as a sham, and I was going to use one of the defense's witnesses to do it. Since I had already done my preparation, all I could do was count down the 120 minutes until I was back at the prosecution table, where I would meet Daryl Brewer for the first time. "The defense may call its next witness," the court said.
"Thank you, Your Honor," Nurmi replied. "The defense calls Daryl Brewer."
I could feel my anticipation rising as I watched the 50-ish-looking Brewer, who was dressed in a black suit, red tie, and dark-framed glasses, raise his right hand to be sworn in. He had requested that the media not show his face, so an agreement had been struck that allowed the cameras in the courtroom to record his testimony but capture his image only from the shoulders down.
"Sir, could you introduce yourself to the jury, please?" Nurmi began.
"My name is Daryl Brewer," he responded in a shaky voice.
"And Daryl, where do you live?"
"I live in Carmel, California."
Brewer testified that he was divorced and had one son, who is now 14.
"And Mr. Brewer, how old are you?"
"I'm 52.
"Okay, do you know this lady here in the blue shirt?" Nurmi asked, pointing to the defense table where Arius sat, staring blankly at Brewer.
"Yes."
"How do you know her?"
"I know Jody because we were in love," he answered in a somewhat rehearsed fashion.
Brewer told the court he met Arius in the fall of 2001 when he was employed as a food and beverage director at Ventana Inn in Big Sur, and Arius came in to apply for a job as a server. His recollection of the date he first met Arius differed from the date he previously provided to the investigator for the defense, at which time he indicated first meeting Arius in 2002.
"And how did she present herself during her interview with you?"
"Outstanding. She was on time, she interviewed well, she was dressed appropriately."
"Now at that point in time you hired Ms. Arius. I would take it to understand that you would be a supervisor to her. Am I correct in understanding that?"
"Yes."
"Okay. And to further clarify for everyone, were you her direct supervisor? Was there a restaurant manager? How did that work?"
"Jody wasn't under my direct supervision. There were other managers involved," he said, being quick to point out that there were managerial layers between them, which would have made a romantic relationship appropriate. But he hastened to add that their dating relationship didn't start until a year later, when he was demoted to server after a change in management. When asked about her job performance, Brewer gave a glowing report and said that she was excelling.
"Okay. And in that time, was there any disciplinary problems, any behavioral problems, anything of that nature, where she was inappropriate with customers or anything like that?"
"No,"
Brewer replied. His answer made me wonder whether she had acquired her bad waitressing habits, documented at Mimi's Cafe and P.F. Chang's, more recently. "Okay. You mentioned there was a shift in management structure at Ventana. You were no longer Jody's boss after that shift, is that correct?"
"That is correct."
"Okay. Did you have a new job title? Could you just kind of describe it for us?"
"Yes. I was working as a server in banquets and helping with weddings," Brewer said, affirming that once he and Arius were co-workers, they became infatuated and fell in love.
"Tell us about who Jody was at that point in time," Nurmi said.
"Jody was a very responsible, caring, loving person," Brewer recounted, as if recommending her for the job of au pair.
Nurmi's inquiry appeared designed to portray a softer image of Arius, and Brewer accommodated the questions, describing her relationship with his young son as outstanding, mentioning she played a friendly role in the boy's life. Brewer testified that even though the two weren't married, they bought a home together in Palm Desert in June of 2005.
"The plan was somewhat uncertain, revolving around my son.
We hoped to stay in the house for a minimum of at least 2 years. We weren't in the process of flipping houses. We wanted to establish the home and possibly resell it.
Okay, so was this part business venture, part home, shall we say? I mean, home to live in, but also a business venture? Nurmi asked.
Not a formal business venture, a personal business venture. I mean, it was a home, but we also looked at it as an investment, hoped to gain from it at some point. But the venture appeared to fall apart in the fall of 2006 when the mother of my son decided to move back to Monterey and took my son as well, and he started school in Pacific Grove in fall of 2006. I was going to follow my son, and I began a strategy how to get back to Monterey. I was trying to find work, and as soon as I found work, I was going to move back to Monterey. My hope was that she, Arias, would remain in the home until we could come to a resolution so we could sell the house.
Okay. In terms of the relationship at this point in time, were you breaking up? Was it going to be a long-distance relationship? What were the discussions about your relationship with Ms. Arias?
Let's see. The relationship was slowly deteriorating over the summer of 2006. By the fall, we were still together in the home, but it was becoming clear that I was moving back to Monterey and that we were not going to be together. Brewer had decided to leave Arias behind, so that it appeared she had no option but to venture into the dating market looking for another man. She also needed to make enough money to pay the mortgage and the bills associated with the ownership of the house. It looked like she was already working two jobs, and the way Brewer described it, she saw a way to get rich quickly by selling memberships to prepaid legal. Brewer said he was unaware of Arias's relationship with Travis Alexander, and he was hoping that Arias would be back with him once they resolved the house issue.
Okay, after you moved to Monterey and the house went into foreclosure, what was your relationship with Jody like during that time period?
I would have to say, at that time, the relationship was nothing more than an occasional phone call. We were not romantically involved, and I had learned that she had left the house and moved to the Arizona area.
Nurmi's final question was, and so you remained friends on good terms?
We did, Brewer responded. Rising from my chair, I wasted no time. I wanted to use Brewer's final answer that he and Arias had remained friends to start my questioning. Turning to Brewer, I began,
Sir, you indicated that you moved from the Palm Desert home back to Monterey in December of 2006, right?
Yes, sir.
And when you moved back, she didn't go with you, right?
Correct.
And even though time passed, you and she continued to be good friends, right?
We talked occasionally.
You were friends then, right? I asked, continuing the questioning in a quick, staccato fashion.
Yes. And she knew your phone number and you knew hers, right?
Yes. And that continued on, for example, into 2007, right? You continued to have this relationship where you were sort of friends, where you would call occasionally, right? And the same thing can be said for 2008, correct? You continued to be this sort of sporadic friend, right?
I had, yes, sporadic contact, yes.
And in fact, back in 2008, she knew your number and you knew hers, right?
Correct.
And if she needed something, she would call you, right? I asked, to which Nurmi objected.
Calls for speculation, he argued, and Judge Stevens sustained his objection.
Well, sir, isn't it true that in May of 2008, you received a telephone call from the defendant, Jody Arias?
I could have, yes, Brewer replied, unaware of where my line of questioning was leading.
Well, isn't it true that during that telephone call, she was asking you for a favor? Do you remember that? I asked, knowing what my next question would be, irrespective of his answer. Do you remember that during that favor, she was asking you for gas cans in May 2008 at the very end so that she could make a trip to Mesa? Do you remember that?
There was a pronounced pause before his one-word answer, delivered in a quiet voice.
Yes, Brewer replied, to a palpable silence in the courtroom.
It was obvious he had been unprepared for the question and was reluctant to respond because he understood the implication of an affirmative answer. Arias had planned the trip to see Travis, and it had not been a spur-of-the-moment decision, as she was now claiming. Before this point, there had been times during the trial when I had observed people in the gallery checking their cell phones, looking around, or whispering to their seatmates. It seemed that now everyone's attention was on the line of questioning, as it was an untouched area, not discussed in these proceedings in either my opening statement or during my case in chief. Moving ahead with my inquiry, I asked Brewer, "And she made more than one call asking you for these gas cans to make a trip to Arizona, didn't she?"
"Yes.
In fact, in the first part of June of 2008, she called you again asking about these gas cans to go to Mesa, right?" I asked, feeling the deafening silence in the courtroom.
"Yes,"
Brewer responded, appearing tentative. "And during the first time that she brought up this issue, in the end of May of 2008, you asked her, 'Why do you need these gas cans?' Do you remember asking her that?"
"I do."
"And she got really testy with you, didn't she?"
"Not necessarily testy. She said she needed them. She was taking a long trip."
"I wouldn't say testy."
"She wouldn't answer you, though, why she wanted those gas cans, right?"
"She did answer me."
"And she told you she was going to Mesa, right?"
"She told me she was going on a long trip. Did not say particularly Mesa, no," he said, changing his earlier answer. "Well, sir," I said, before showing Brewer the interview summary that had been turned over to me years earlier by previous defense counsel, which contained that portion of his conversation with their investigator, "let's go ahead and mark this as an exhibit and see if this refreshes your recollection, okay?" Presenting Brewer with a copy of the interview summary marked Exhibit 411, I directed him to read the highlighted portion, which referred to his comment that Arias had gotten testy.
"You do admit that you had a conversation with somebody representing the defendant, right?"
"I did have a conversation, yes, sir."
"And did this refresh your recollection as to the fact that she got testy with you or not?"
"No," Brewer replied. "And with regard to going to Mesa, Arizona, does that refresh your recollection or not?" I asked.
"No,"
Brewer responded, appearing to dig in his heels, but it was obvious that the damage had already been done, because the jury had already heard him admit that Arias told him she was traveling to Mesa, so his backtracking was ineffectual.
"But she said she was going to go on a trip, right?"
"She did."
"And that's why she wanted to borrow the gas cans, right?"
"Yes."
"And ostensibly the reason that she wanted these gas cans is because she was going to get lost, right?"
I asked the question to remind the jury of Arias's story to Detective Flores that she had gotten lost in an effort to explain the 24-hour absence to him.
"I don't know that she had any plans to get lost, no."
"That's what she told you, that was part of the reason why she needed the gas cans, right?"
"No,"
Brewer said emphatically.
"Sir, she did come by your house on June 3rd of 2008, right, before her trip, right? She came by and she had breakfast with you, right?"
"We had some food, yes."
Brewer demurred in an obvious effort to avoid admitting even those facts that were undeniably true, including that food served in the morning is called breakfast.
"And your son was there, right? That was around 7 o'clock in the morning, right?"
"Approximately, yes."
"And while she was there, you allowed her to use the email on your computer, right? And she checked her email, right?"
"Yes," Brewer affirmed.
"And before she left, though, you gave her two gas cans, didn't you?" I asked, my voice emphasizing the point.
"I did."
"They were each 5-gallon gas cans, right? For a total of 10 gallons that would be available to put in these gas cans, right?"
"The cans would have held 10 gallons, yes."
"What color were the cans?" I asked.
"They were red."
"And when you gave her these cans at the time, did you ask her what she was going to use them for or not?"
"At the time, no," he offered,
appearing to bait me into asking him about the other times they may have discussed her reason for wanting to borrow the gasoline containers. "Okay, let me show you some exhibits," I said, referring to the receipts. Arias had made the three gas purchases beginning at 8:42 p.m. on June 3, 2008, according to the timestamp on the first receipt. "It says it's pump number 2, and it does give gallons, right?"
"It does," Brewer acknowledged.
"It's 8.301 gallons, and then it gives the price, and then there's a payment there, right? And the time I want you to note is 8:42 p.m., right?"
"Yes," he admitted, unable to deny the obvious.
I next showed Brewer the second receipt from the purchase that Arias made 4 minutes later at 8:46 p.m.
"About how much gas? Can you see how many gallons she purchased there?"
Brewer reluctantly replied, "Looks like 9.954 gallons.
That's approximately close to 10 gallons, right?"
To which Brewer responded affirmatively.
"Then if we look at this other one, this other exhibit, we'll go with the time first. It's 8:53 p.m., right? See that in the upper left?" I asked, showing him the last ARCO receipt, driving home the point that Arias made three separate gas purchases during that stop.
"And this is for," I asked, soliciting from Brewer the number of gallons indicated on this final receipt.
"It looks like 2.77-something, Brewer said.
"Right. And if we add, let's say, 2.7, the amount of gas Arias bought during her last purchase, and round it, referring to the 9.954 gallons shown to have been purchased during the second transaction, up to 10, we're talking about 12.5 gallons, right?"
This was the combined amount of gas that had been purchased with cash rather than a credit card at this ARCO station.
"Yes," Brewer replied.
"Let's do a little bit of basic math," I challenged. "Let's say the car she was driving had a capacity of 12 gallons, using that number for ease of mathematical computation, although I knew the tank capacity of the Ford Focus was 13.5 gallons.
"Objection, speculative," Nurmi interrupted.
Pausing my examination, I waited for Judge Stevens, who quickly overruled his objection.
"And if you multiply that by 30 miles per gallon, let's just say that it's highway driving," I continued. "That would be 360 miles, right?"
"I imagine, if your math is correct," Brewer agreed. After establishing the potential range of the Ford Focus, I turned to a discussion of the other gas receipts from the ARCO station in Pasadena. On the other two exhibits, receipts for the second and third gas purchases at ARCO, we talked about, we have roughly the same amount, 12.5 gallons. Did you notice that? Do you remember that?
"Yes.
And so if we're talking about the same 30 miles to the gallon, 12.5, we're talking about roughly another 360 miles, right?"
"Makes sense.
So if a person fills up, for example, in Pasadena, according to the math that we're doing, and puts 12 gallons in this car, and we're talking 30 miles, and I understand these are rough figures, you're talking 360. Plus the other 12.5 gallons, another 360, for a total of 720 miles, right?" I asked, knowing that this analysis was predicated on Arias only having two gas cans at her disposal.
"Correct."
As I wound down my questions about the gas cans, I still had one more point to make.
"The gas cans, sir, did she ever return them to you?" I asked.
"No," Brewer replied.
"Ever ask her about returning those gas cans to you?"
"I don't recall if I ever had a chance to ask her, no." Moving on from the gas cans, I then turned my attention to other areas of his testimony, addressing the chronology of his relationship with Arias, with a focus on their sexual dynamic. I wanted to build off the work I'd done through Ryan Burns's testimony that showed Arias as sexually aggressive, in order to further undermine her claim that Travis was a Svengali who guilted her into submitting to his sexual whims.
I asked Brewer to confirm his earlier testimony that he and Arias had started to date in January of 2003. And you sort of made it official at the San Francisco 49ers game, right?
Yes.
And you spent the night together, right?
We did.
And is that the first time you and she ever had sex? I asked.
No,
Brewer replied. And you do remember the first time you and she had sex, though, right?
I do remember, yes.
And she was very aggressive, wasn't she?
We were both aggressive, Brewer equivocated.
To refresh his memory about his earlier statement to the defense investigator, I showed him the portion of his interview summary in which he had described Arias as aggressive during their first sexual encounter.
It says that, right? I asked.
That's what it says, yes, Brewer conceded. And not only was she aggressive, she was enthusiastic about it, wasn't she? The sex, I mean.
We were both enthusiastic, yes, he answered in an obvious attempt to shield Arias.
And she was comfortable with intimacy, yes?
Yes.
And at some point you and she even enjoyed, I believe on two occasions, anal sex, right? I was forced to ask this question because Arias had maintained that the only person she had ever engaged in this type of sexual activity with had been Travis, and it was at his insistence.
Possibly once, Brewer responded.
Ending my cross-examination of Brewer, I started back to the prosecution table, where I caught sight of Detective Flores fighting to hold back an inquisitive smile. As I sat down next to him, he broke the cardinal rule that I had established for him for the trial, which was to never speak to me while court was in session, because we ran the risk of being overheard, as the microphones at the table were very sensitive.
What the heck was that all about?
He whispered into my ear. You didn't tell me anything about the gas cans.
I know, I acknowledged. No one knew.
As I sat back in my chair, Flores and I exchanged a glance, wondering how Nurmi was going to address what was clearly a blow to Arias's self-defense claim. Nurmi took his opportunity on redirect examination in a direction that I found perplexing.
Mr. Brewer, did your sex life with Jody Arias involve wearing little boys' underwear? Did it involve putting her in schoolgirl outfits and pigtails? Did it involve bending her over a desk? Did it involve ejaculating on her face? Did it involve calling her a whore, a slut, a three-hole wonder?
To all of which, Brewer replied, no. That Nurmi chose to focus on questions about all the things that Arias had not done with Daryl Brewer, and in such a vulgar way, was surprising. But what I found even more strange was his failure to address the reason Arias borrowed the gas cans from Brewer and the receipts proving she had purchased gas to fill those gas cans, manifesting her intent to use them on her trip to Mesa.
Okay, now as related to the gas cans and where Jody was going on different occasions, one of the occasions you said was Mesa. One occasion you said was a long trip, so I just want to clarify that with you.
Nurmi posed the question, which had the effect of discrediting his own witness.
I believe that Jody told me she was going on a long trip. She was going to see friends in Big Sur and Los Angeles and in Arizona and the Grand Canyon, I believe, is what she said.
Brewer said, attempting to clarify his earlier testimony and cast doubt on the interview summary attributed to him by the defense investigator, claiming he hadn't approved the statement prior to it being submitted by defense counsel.
Okay, and so when you heard Mesa, or comments about Mesa when you were asked about it, that wasn't accurate to your recollection of where she was going, right?
Nurmi led Brewer to the answer, trying to deal with the fact that the witness had already admitted twice on cross-examination that Arias had told him that she needed the gas cans for her trip to Mesa.
That's correct.
She said Arizona. I didn't know of Mesa, Brewer said, as if he had just gotten the answer right. And as for the gas cans themselves and what Arias wanted them for, Nurmi left that whole area wholly untouched.
Apparently, Arias hadn't given Brewer an explanation that he was willing to share. Chapter 19. The assault on Travis Alexander's reputation and character, which would be the linchpin of Jody Arias's self-defense claim, began in earnest on the second day, with testimony from the next three witnesses the defense called to the stand. Lisa Andrews, who was now married and went by the name Lisa DeDoni, had dated Travis on and off for about 8 months, beginning in July 2007, when she was 19 years old. DeDoni's testimony centered on an angry email she sent to Travis after one of their breakups. She complained to him in that email that sex was on his mind from the very beginning and they made out too long and too passionately, which caused her to feel used and dirty. The email also included a concern that he had grabbed her butt in public, which upset her further when he persisted on doing it even after she asked him to stop. Throughout the direct examination by Jennifer Wilmot, DeDoni made it clear that she felt the intent of her email was being taken out of context, even as she was forced to admit she had authored it. Although I had initially thought I might call DeDoni as a witness, I had chosen not to, because I was concerned that she might unwittingly bring up details about her breakup with Travis, such as her belief that Arias had been the one to slash Travis's tires, or recount the night she fell asleep at Travis's house and Travis found Arias downstairs, at which time Arias admitted to having been upstairs watching the two sleep. Any such statements touching on other misdeeds by Arias could result in a mistrial, which would require us to start the trial all over again. Despite the content of the letter, I didn't consider Lisa DeDoni's questioning by Wilmot particularly impactful, as it was based almost exclusively on a single email DeDoni had written to Travis early in their relationship, explaining why she believed they should break up. On cross-examination, DeDoni readily admitted that she and Travis had had a high school-type relationship, that she had expressed herself in an immature fashion in the email, and that she now believed her comments were unfair. She said her complaint that he was overly interested in sex was in part because Travis became erect when they kissed, something she now acknowledged was a normal bodily reaction and not a result of any purposeful touching. She also mentioned that Travis only began kissing her after she made the overture by asking him to kiss her first. During my cross-examination, DeDoni expanded on her answer to Wilmot that she broke up with Travis because of strange things that were happening by discussing two incidents that concerned her. On the first occasion, she and Travis were together at her house when someone suddenly opened the front door. She explained that the door had a security device that made a ringing noise every time it was opened, and when she and Travis heard it go off, they went to see who had come in and found that no one was there. DeDoni said she became so worried that someone might have broken into the house that she asked Travis to spend the night, pointing out that during the overnight stay at her home, Travis did not make any sexual advances, and they did not engage in any passionate kissing. On a different occasion, she was at Travis's house, standing in the kitchen, when Arias unexpectedly walked in through the front door, and upon seeing DeDoni, turned around and ran out. DeDoni's testimony, far from showing that Travis was abusive in any way, instead painted a picture of an individual with values who respected his girlfriend's sexual boundaries. After DeDoni's testimony, the defense continued its attack on Travis's character by calling two of Travis's friends, Daniel Freeman and his sister Desiree, to testify about behavior on Travis's part toward Arias that they deemed inappropriate. The Freemans were both members of the LDS Church, and Daniel was also affiliated with PPL. Desiree, the first of the two siblings to take the stand, told the jury that her brother had first introduced her to Travis, who then introduced her to Arias. In response to questions from Wilmot, she recounted what she described as a disturbing exchange between Travis and Arias during a trip to Havasupai, Arizona, that she and her brother took with the couple in September 2007.
Desiree recalled that at one point, Arias got out of the car to take some photographs, and Travis pretended to drive away as she tried to get back into the vehicle. She said that Arias became upset and told Travis it wasn't funny, which angered Travis, whose over-the-top reaction shocked Desiree. While she could not recall exactly what Travis said to Arias that day, she made it clear that she found his tone inappropriate. I initiated my cross-examination of Desiree Freeman by asking her questions about the LDS Church's prohibition against sexual activities by unmarried members. This was a way to remind the jury that Arias had violated the church's doctrine by being with both Travis and Ryan Burns in a sexual way within a day of each other. On the face of it, Desiree's testimony about Travis's accelerating the car was not particularly helpful to the defense's case. His actions did not rise to being verbally abusive to Arias. Although Desiree described this incident as over the top, she couldn't remember the words she found so offensive, and when pressed on the specifics, her memory totally failed, and she couldn't recall anything about an argument that Travis and Arias supposedly had before their trip. I didn't belabor the point because I saw no need to get drawn into a character debate with her about what was essentially a trivial exchange between Travis and Arias. Desiree's brother Daniel recounted on direct examination a fight between Travis and Arias that he said occurred the morning the foursome was scheduled to go to Havasupai in the Grand Canyon, which Daniel admitted he had incited by complaining that Arias was packing too much makeup for the day's hike. When he voiced his concerns, he said Travis also became upset after he realized how much she had packed, causing Travis to raise his voice at her and sending Arias running upstairs in tears. This was the argument between Travis and Arias that had somehow slipped Desiree's mind, even though by her own testimony she was there. Daniel's testimony began to illustrate the lengths defense counsel had gone to show Travis was abusive by blaming Travis for a situation sparked by his friend Daniel Freeman. The defense case took a salacious turn in their approach with the testimony of their next two witnesses, one being a digital media expert and the other professing an expertise in many areas, including voice comparison and identification and photography. Lonnie Dworkin, the digital media expert, had been retained by the defense to examine Travis's compact Presario laptop, seized by police during their investigation on June 10, 2008. As well as two items belonging to Jody Arias, an external hard drive and a Helio cell phone. The external hard drive had been found by police during the execution of the search warrant on Arias' grandparents' house in Wairika on July 15, 2008. The Helio cell phone had a more complicated history. Arias had reported to the Wairika Police Department on May 18, 2008, that it had been stolen from the front seat of her car, and police had no record of a follow-up call from Arias notifying them that the phone had been recovered. After confirming his educational background and experience, Wilmot asked Dworkin about his examination of Travis's laptop, specifically the internet history and the different websites that Travis had visited in the early morning hours of June 4, 2008, between 4:08 and 4:35 a.m. "Can you tell us about the first full action?" Wilmot asked, referring to a listing from his report of the websites Travis had visited that morning. "What is it telling us?" "Well, it's an action that documents a website that was visited and the date and time the website was visited," Dworkin replied. "Okay, can you tell us what website was visited?" "Yes, it was YouTube.com, and the date and time is June 4th, 2008, at 4:08:11 a.m.
"Does it tell us anything else in that action?"
"Yes. It tells us the name of the file that was accessed, the YouTube file that was accessed."
"Okay, and what was that?"
"The title of the file is Drunk, Daft Punk, Hard Body, Faster, Stronger," Dworkin replied. By providing no further details about the file, his response made it seem like Travis had accessed a YouTube website dedicated to pornographic materials, but I knew otherwise.
These were music videos for the band Daft Punk and did not have any sexual content. Wilmot's inquiry ignored that Arias had previously described this video to Detective Flores when she was questioned on July 16, 2008, and she had told him that Travis was viewing some stupid music video with people dancing with foil boxes on their heads. The next action? Wilmot continued in what seemed like a deliberate attempt to create the impression for the jury that Travis had viewed pornography. The time is 4:11 a.m. in the morning and 4 seconds.
Okay, what's the website? What's the date?
The date is also June 4th, 2008. The website is youtube.com, Dworkin said, adding, "The title of the video that was viewed is Daft Hands, Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger."
And the next action? Wilmot elicited. Let's start with the date.
Okay, June 4th, 2008.
And the time?
It's 4:15 and 13 seconds in the morning.
Okay, and the website?
The website is again youtube.com.
Does it tell specifically where on YouTube?
The title of this file is Daft Hands, Double Speed, Faster, Better.
The purposeful way Wilmot was posing the questions appeared to be a deliberate attempt to lead the jury to make assumptions, making it difficult for me to sit and wait until I could question the witness and clear up the impression being created during direct examination. Wilmot next turned her focus to Dworkin's examination of an external hard drive, a portable storage device that he described as the size of a hard drive you would find on a laptop. Wilmot failed to immediately identify the owner of this hard drive, leaving room for the jury to assume that it belonged to Travis, because Dworkin's testimony thus far had been related to his examination of Travis's laptop. Were you asked by defense counsel to pull photographs, everything you can, off the mirror image hard drive?
Wilmot asked, to which Dworkin indicated that, in addition to photos, he had also been able to access some other information from a mirror image he made of the actual hard drive.
Do you recognize those as two photos taken off of this mirror image?
Wilmot asked, focusing Dworkin's attention to Defense Exhibits 393 and 394, two 8.5 by 11 glossy photographs, each depicting a man's penis. The photographs were enlarged in such a fashion that the penis in one measured 8.5 inches and in the other 9¾ inches, in an obvious attempt to shock whoever viewed the pictures.
Defense moves to enter exhibit number
393 and 394, responded Dworkin as he held up the pictures, allowing the jury and those in the courtroom to see that each exhibit was an enlarged photograph of a man's penis. I stood up and objected on the grounds of relevance, pointing out that Dworkin could not identify